You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting. Happy Friday. End of another week. Weekend is upon us. A couple little notes here before we get into our discussion. Or should I say back into our discussion from yesterday. Finish up the Boston bombing. Boston bombing, the Boston Strangler. I'm not awake yet this morning, don't mind me. Just to mention this, listener Tammy, who calls in from time to time, sent an article. I just got it this morning, sent it last night. This was in the news yesterday. The headline reads, lawsuit Lake Zurich High hazing included forced sex acts. This is in the Chicago Tribune. This high school is now a lawsuit being launched because several senior football players were forcing new recruits on the team, freshmen apparently, to perform lewd sex acts, and this was being done right under the nose of the coach and other staff. It was known, and yet it was allowed, apparently, to go on for years. So, you know, here's yet another example, guys. Whether it's at the highest levels in Washington or lower levels in local communities, this stuff is so pervasive. It's even more pervasive than I'd imagine. As listeners send me more and more links, I'm not surprised. In fact, it's just confirming what I've been saying, that this is far worse than what we can imagine. The more we dig, the more we find, and the more we begin to realize, wow, we have missed the elephant in the living room. The thing is so huge, crapping all over the place, and yet it's amazing. People don't see it. It's right there. How can you miss it? Well, before I get back into our discussion on the Boston Strangler, just got to mention these few little tidbits here. This is freaking amazing, man. Hold on. Yeah, I had a feeling I did that. Well, what do you know? Just discovered something I never noticed before. How to fix a problem on my computer that keeps re-emerging. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that, but what do you know? Learn something new every day. I've had this computer for years. Anyway, got to mention this stuff, guys. This is unbelievable. Let's see, which do I cover first? Yeah, let's mention this first. Mr. Stephen Colbert of the Colbert Report, you know, on Comedy Central, never really liked the guy. It was just something about him, and it, well, I mean, he's an elite big bastard anyway, but excuse me. But other than the fact of who he is and what he represents, the fact that he works for mainstream media, you don't work with mainstream media, become a big public icon, you know, unless you're a piece of garbage, guys. So you literally can prejudge people in that context. Yes, you can. If you're a big name, it doesn't matter if it's a celebrity, you know, a movie star or a musician, or there might be a few exceptions, but guys, almost every time, if you make a prejudgment, you're on the right track with these people, because you just don't get, it's certainly that way in politics, and often in academia, in the religious world. You have, like I said, a few low-level people that are exceptions, but the higher up the ladder you go, no, there's no exception. You're a scumbag if you, in fact, hold a high position in pretty much any area of society. You can just assume that's the case. Now, hopefully, you'll proceed to look into it to make sure so that you're not actually being, quote, prejudiced and prejudging. But if you make that assumption, most of the time, you're not going to be disappointed. You're going to find out, yep, look at that son of a gun. That's how we got there, and, you know. In ages past, it was easier to slip through the cracks if you were a decent person and climb the ladder. It did happen more often back, you know, decades ago. Not anymore, guys. The stakes are too high. The corruption is too pervasive now. The crimes are too, you know, way over the top. They can't afford to let decent, scrupled people through their filtration system. So, yes, you can conclude Mr. Colbert must be a scumbag just because of the position he has, being in the limelight, you know. And, well, lo and behold, upon close inspection, we discover, yeah, we are justified in drawing that conclusion. I never liked the guy just because of his, aside from the fact that he has a high position, you know, as an icon, a national icon, and that he's an elite scumbag. But there was just something about him, aside from all that, that rubbed me the wrong way. Just gave me this sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. His snarliness, just that little weaselly, gooky grin on his face, you just want to pound him. Well, now we've got even more reason to want to pound this little scoundrel. On one of his shows a few weeks back, I didn't realize this till yesterday, thanks to a listener who sent the link, he made a comment about Pizzagate. Here's what he said. And by the way, before he made this comment, he quotes that statement from his not-so-holiness there, you know, over in Rome, talking about fake news and how his holiness said that, you know, people who are slandering government leaders with fake news stories, their infatuation with this is akin to, you know, those who have twisted fantasies regarding feces. He actually said that. People who spread, quote, fake news, slandering politicians. Well, you know, you don't have to slander them because they do it themselves. If you pay attention to what they're doing, you'll see that they slander their own selves. You don't have to slander them. Their own lifestyle slanders them. But anyway, nevertheless, his not-so-holiness, who himself has a big, huge closet filled with skeletons, but here he is defending these, you know, exemplary politicians, using the fake news label, and he compares people who have a fetish for spreading fake news with those who have a feces fetish. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? taking advantage of his position, knowing that people look up to him, so he can defend. Oh my God, it's just, it's so over the top, unbelievable. Anyway, I'll read this quote from him in a minute. It's jaw-dropping, but I think we got to call him on the line. You there, caller?
Hey, I'm just listening, Charlie.
Oh, okay, hey, no problem, man.
Right.
Anyway, so here's what he said. He said, the craziest fake news of all. Just before he makes this statement, you know, he cites a couple other examples, you know. He's just throwing them out there to make it look like he's got a big laundry list and there's a whole bunch of fake news out there. But those previous one or two items he mentioned, they're of no significance. He just tossed that in there. The real reason he brought up the fake news thing is because he wanted to shill for his buddies and, as we'll see in a minute, himself as well, in the whole Pizzagate fiasco. Oh, yes, he's connected with it. He's not just covering for his buddies. He's covering his own sleazy little hind parts. But now he says, the craziest fake news of all, he says, is something called Pizzagate. People actually believe, he said, a conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton and her former campaign manager, John Podesta, ran a child sex ring at a pizzeria in D.C. Could you imagine that people would actually believe such a thing? Why, Hillary is such a great person. She's above reproach, ladies and gentlemen, and to say nothing of her former campaign manager, Mr. John Podesta. Why? Could you believe people would think anything amiss about these two exemplary individuals? It's shocking! Listen to this guy. It's so disgusting. And then he says, we all know the only people trapped in a pizza place are those robots at Chuck E. Cheese. And of course, everybody's laughing. Ha ha. Yes, he throws a little joke in there to lighten it up. But he's really angry. You can see it in his face. Colbert went on to say, a lot of uninformed, gullible people fell for the Clinton-Podesta sex ring theory. You know, I didn't forget to quote it. He said, this is a lie. He looks right at the camera, right in the context of telling his little jokes and getting people to laugh. He looks at the camera really angry. This is a lie, you know, with fire beaming out of his eyes. It's obvious, guys. He has a personal axe to grind in saying that. He's not just covering for his buddy. He uses his little comedic antics to preach a sermon to sway people away from looking into the truth of this matter. Anyway, it looks like we do have another caller. I think he's calling to make a comment. You there, caller?
Yeah, I'm just listening, Charlie.
Oh, okay, buddy. Sorry, man.
No problem. Thanks, man.
Batting 1,000 this morning. Anyway, notice he says a lot of uninformed, gullible people fell for the Clinton-Podesta sex ring theory. How many of his mindless, groveling fools heard that and decided, I'm either never going to look into that now if I should hear anything about it, or decided, yeah, I was going to look into it. I had a neighbor tell me about that the other day, but I don't forget it now. Chris Colbert said it's not true, so I don't forget it. That. What a lie. Yeah. Oh, dear, they talk about our politicians that way. And in fact, didn't the Pope just make a comment, too, about that? I got to look that up. I think the Pope said something. The most mindless, gullible saps, ladies and gentlemen. That's the end of the story right there. There's no looking into it any further. There's no need to. If Chris, Stephen. Stephen Colbert says it's not true, that's the end of it for me. And then if the Pope confirms that as well, why? See how they use their positions, or others have them use their positions as their spokespeople. You know, hey, hey, yeah, why don't you go on record as making a comment, blah, blah, blah. Because they know most people who fall under that umbrella, who are in that camp, even people who had already started to look into it, it started to make sense. I think of a mindless arse years ago that I was talking to about 9/11. Gullible as they come. But as we were talking, I could tell it was really getting through to him. I really hit him hard, you know, with some hard, hard evidence, stuff he just could not argue with. He tried at first, but as it went on, suddenly he stopped and he's listening. And you could just see the look of shock on his face. He probably never heard anything like that his entire life, right? So after we're done, he's like, wow, you've really blown me away. I don't know what to say. You know, he's like, wow, I got to look into this. Well, do you know what his looking into this consisted of? This was on a Saturday night. He went to church the next morning. Whee! Out the window went that. That was the end of it. There was no discussing the whole matter with him ever again. I saw him late in the that afternoon. I said, hey, did you have a chance to look into some of the things that... Oh, no, I'm not going to bother. Never mind. Just, let's not even go there. I'm like, well, what do you mean? What happened? Well, I was talking to my pastor this morning, and... That's the end of it right there. Don't even bother. Don't waste your time. All over. The light began to dawn. He started to see, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. But the minute he goes and talks to his little huckster of the cloth buddy, that was the end of it. His beloved man of God shut the door and forever sealed it on him. That's it. Bolted it, riveted the thing, you know, welded it shut. That's how it is with most people, guys. So you get this little scum-sucking sleazebag, Colbert, making a statement like that. How many millions of people do you want to bet shut the door on it? So now they meet with their friend the next day who was telling them about it.
Oh, forget it. You guys are crazy with your nutbag conspiracy theory. He even quoted the Pope. The Pope is even exposing this as a fraud. You guys will believe anything. Sure, I don't like Hillary. I know she's a criminal, but to say something like that, that's just so over-the-top ridiculous.
Whereas the day before when you talked to him, you were reaching him. And if you could get him to the point where he would now look at the evidence for himself, he would see it. But now, hearing someone like that, that they look up to and respect, that they think has an aura of respectability, that shuts the door on it right there. Doesn't have to be a religious leader. You know, people look up to their political leaders, they're heroes in the comedy world, whatever. Usually a combination of different ones. When they hear it from the Pope and, you know, their favorite political pundit or media talking head or whatever, you know, that's it, it's over. There's no investigating into the matter, no looking into it. Why, that's too much work. I don't need to do that anyway. These people that I respect, that are so respectable, have already done the work for me. Imagine that it works that way. I mean, common sense, whatever that term means anymore, should dictate that it doesn't work that way. That people would actually take the initiative to look into it for themselves. Who cares what the opinions are, whether those people you respect actually are respectable or not, because there are people who pawn lies off but don't know that they're doing it, right? You could have your local pastor lying to you but not knowing that he's lying. He could truly be sincere, but it doesn't matter. His sincerity is no substitute for the truth. Or his sincerity doesn't mean that he's telling the truth. He could be sincerely passing off a lie and not know it. That people rest so much depend so much on their leaders, whatever field it is. I can't understand that one. It's not like I can say, well, you know, I used to be that way. I was never that way. Never. Never. Once, as a kid, I was like 12 years old. I think I told the story before. I asked a minister a question. The answer I got was so upsetting to me. I was so insulted that he was trying to give me the brush off. I couldn't believe that he had no interest in discussing it was a serious question. It wasn't some immature little kid, just being a pest. I had a legitimate, serious question. He just didn't want to be bothered. I couldn't believe it. I was so shocked by that. That was the only time I ever went to someone in a position of authority and trusted them as a source. Not that I trusted him, but I just wanted his opinion, right? That was it. After that, guys, I learned if I wanted to find an answer, I had to dig for it myself. And that's what I always and ever did thereafter. The only other time I ever wanted an opinion was I was a freshman in college. And not that I respected the guy, not that I was going to base my understanding on the matter on his response, but I did want his response. I was curious to hear what he was going to say. He was one of the top theology majors at the time. He was a senior. I was a freshman. We were talking about corruption in the church and everything. So I shared with him my findings about the Trinity. I thought, oh, if anybody can be trusted, this guy, he won't say anything because he knows the system is corrupt too, right? So, I was curious to hear what he had to say. My mind was pretty much already made up at the time, so I wasn't going to base my opinion on what he said. No, I learned that I needed to base my opinion on my own research. But nevertheless, I thought I could trust him, and I was curious to see what he was going to say. Oh, boy, that curiosity got satisfied real fast. I found out what his response was going to be. He turned me in. He handed my paper into the head of the theology department. The very next day, I get called into his office, raked over the coals. Unbelievable. He didn't even read it. He didn't even want to read it. He had no interest in reading it. He pretended he was interested so he could get a copy of it and hand it in and get some freaking brownie points because he was going to be graduating soon and he wanted to ensure he would have a job because, of course, most seniors, after graduating with their bachelor's, didn't get a call into the ministry. They had to go on to get their master's. So he wanted to override all that, and he did. He did. He got a job right away. Of course, within a year, I discovered he got defrocked because he got caught sleeping with the head elder's wife. No surprise there. But other than that, guys, I never cared about anybody's opinion, never asked. So I can't relate to that. Even when I went to this pastor as a 12-year-old kid, I wasn't prepared to accept his explanation as the final answer. I just wanted his twist on it. And then from there, I'll look it up from that perspective and see if it adds up. But okay, yeah, that makes sense now. That answers that. But most people don't do that. They'll ask a monkey like that, and that's the end of it. I can't relate to that. I can't. I never have been able to. I never will, and I'm glad for it. But that's apparently how most people work. I didn't realize that. It took me a while to figure it out that I thought everybody, checked into stuff, or at least if they didn't check into it, once you showed them the information you found because you checked into it, that would be enough to convince anybody of anything if you had your ducks in line, No, 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 no. Oh, no, 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 no. It took me a while to figure out that people don't work that way for the most part. I couldn't believe it. Here I was a kid, and I could see that, no, you have to look into stuff for yourself. And as time went on, I was seeing that adults weren't doing this. Of course, as I got older, I realized, oh, my God, it's always been this way, hasn't it? I've often talked with a friend of mine. In fact, I just saw him the other day. We went out for dinner and caught up on the goings-on in our lives. We haven't talked in a little while. Anyway, This is the guy who left the church when I did. He's the only one. Him and his wife, you know, had left when I did. We were talking just the other day. What is it about, you know, the two of us that enabled us to see this fraudulent system for what it was and left organized religion altogether? What is it about us that enabled us to do that, whereas everybody else just follows along in suit, doesn't question it? Even when you show them that things aren't right, they still don't want to. What is it? What is it? Is it genetics? Is it just being in the right place at the right time? Having been screwed by a system long enough, strong enough, that, you know, you don't trust anything or anybody anymore? What is it? What is it? What made us open-minded to look into things for ourselves and conclude, yeah, screw this, I'm done with it? Whereas 99.9% of the rest of them just follow right in line and you know, don't question anything. Anyway, back to Colbert here. He was really going out of his way to defend Hillary and Podesta guys and the whole Pizzagate thing. Why? Because, as it turns out, his name was mentioned, ladies and gentlemen, numerous times in the Podesta emails that WikiLeaks released. How do you like that? Not only that, but his sister's fundraiser, which was called An Evening with Stephen Colbert, you know, in her run for Congress back in 2013 in South Carolina. This fundraiser was hosted by none other than Tony and John Podesta. Well, what do you know about that? No wonder his face got so stern and he looked so angry when he so affirmatively... Guys, welcome back. Anyway, that was an awful long, dragged out, half an hour long update, the Pizzagate thing. That should have only taken a half a minute. But anyway, how do you like that, Mr. Colbert? What a scumbag. But here's another interesting little tidbit here. A listener sent me a link yesterday informing me of a new TV series that's coming out on Netflix. I thought it was supposed to start today, but I guess it's going to start later this month, the 23rd or something. But anyway, check this out, guys. This is so vomit-inducing. But it's right in line with what we've been talking about, the demoralization of society. They want to introduce, like I said, you know, pedophilia as something acceptable, or at least to get you to accept it as, you know, most people will never, hopefully, will never accept it as the norm, but at least they want you to be so exposed to it, to see that's going on so much that you'll throw your arms up in despair and figure, well, you can't fight it, it's just too big. So, you know, either way, they want you to become desensitized to it, so it won't be so shocking when you hear about it. You'll just say, oh, it's horrible, but hey, what can you do about it, you know? In addition to that, guys, there's other stuff that they're doing, too. They're tearing us down, demoralizing and desensitizing us from every conceivable angle. They want us to, you know, ultimately, to accept the most evil, the most depraved things as, quote, the norm. Now, here's another example of this. This TV series coming out on Netflix, going to be called Santa Clarita Diet, and it's going to be starring Drew Barrymore. And I'll tell you, don't do it unless you have a strong stomach. But actually, I don't even have a strong stomach. But I did, you know, watch the trailer for it. The video had some stuff in it, but then I went ahead and looked up the trailer. It goes into more detail. Wow, is this messed up. Guess what the storyline is in this series. And what scares me, guys, it's probably going to be popular. It's probably going to be a really prominently talked about show. It's going to be the new thing, you know, that people are going to be into. The theme of the show is cannibalism. Drew Barrymore plays a character, a housewife, who has an interesting hobby or fetish. She likes eating human flesh. That's the whole storyline of the whole series. And they glamorize it or glorify it by making it out to look like not only something acceptable, but something actually welcomed, because the victims that she chooses for her cannibalism are the refuse of society, criminals that got away with their crimes, or, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So she's providing a service, you see. And so they make it look like something good. And, of course, I'm sure they're going to have some humor thrown in there as well. Hardy, har, har, har. But there's scenes, guys, of her holding on to an arm severed from the elbow up. So she's holding it in both her hands, like you would hold, you know, like Fred Flintstone with one of the dinosaur ribs there that he's gnawing on. You know, she's holding this arm and biting into it. She pulls her face away from it, and of course there's blood all over her face, you know. And you can call it fake blood, but you know what? Hey, nothing would surprise me. It looks pretty real to me. But in any case, it doesn't matter. She's holding this arm, the hand is there, all the fingers, the whole thing. This is unbelievable, man. This is so incredibly freaking disgusting. So sick. Look how this is going to degrade and demoralize society even more, guys. They're glamorizing and glorifying the most hideous, disgusting, vulgar, filthy, despicable trash. That ought to tell you something about Little Miss Drew Barrymore, too. What kind of a character must you have, guys? She doesn't have to accept that role. She could say, you know what? No, I'm not going there. I don't care what you're going to pay me. You know, I'll do Revlon commercials or something. I'm not going there. To accept a role like that, you got to be a little touched, a little twisted, have a few little screws loose in the first place. Anyway, let's see here. I'm going ahead of myself. Yeah, there's another scene where there's a bowl of, it just looks like a bunch of bloody slop. Apparently she had flayed one of her victims and made some kind of a stew with it. But it's all raw, though, you know. And you can see an eyeball in the dish, too. And so as she's talking, she's dipping her finger into the, I think she has a chip or something. She's made like a dip with it. Oh, my God. Can you imagine? People are going to watch this. I guarantee you guys, I bet this is going to be a popular show. I just have that feeling. Something similar to this that I watched with some friends, and, you know, I have to admit, the storyline was kind of interesting. It did pull you in. But there were some incredibly disgusting scenes in this series, too. I think that was made for Netflix as well. No, it wasn't. It was made for American Movie Network or something, whatever the hell. Yeah, it was some cable network. Anyway, Breaking Bad. You guys remember that series a few years back? I hate to admit it, but the storyline kind of drew you in. I got addicted to it. We watched the whole thing. Long. But guys, that's the whole idea. They make the plot gripping. They have you on the edge of your seat, so you keep coming back and watching more. You want to see what happens next. But all the while, they're filling your mind with all kinds of vulgarity. Not very far removed from this cannibal thing. Not quite as bad, but, you know, there was some incredibly grotesque stuff in there. Like, for example, in one of the shows, for those that didn't see this series, it's about this high school teacher. He's a chemist, and he figures out how he can make the best, methamphetamine on the market. Because of his knowledge of chemistry, he can make it more pure than anybody else, you know, offers a better high, blah, 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 blah. So he gets together with a former student of his, been out of school now for years, you know, and they cook up this scheme where they're going to start making meth and selling it, you know. Anyway, he becomes a millionaire, but in the process, they run into some very unsavory characters that they have to eliminate. Two of the people, very early in the series, that they have to get rid of, it's two Mexicans, I guess, that, you know, they're trying to muscle in on their turf, and they're trying to kill them, so they wind up killing the Mexicans instead. But now what to do with these bodies? The main character, the chemistry teacher there, he gets a hold of a vat of I forget what they call it, but there's a chemical solution that dissolves human flesh, just completely, you know, eats it off the bone. In fact, it dissolves bone too, so that there's nothing left. You can just pull the whole thing down the drain and there's all your evidence gone. Anyway, so they kind of make it look, you know, kind of funny in a way. It's not a comedy show, but some of the stuff is kind of comedic because it's like Murphy's Law. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. So the teacher realizes, oh, we don't have enough. I got to get some more. So he tells the kid, you know, be careful with this stuff. It's very dangerous. Don't mess with it. I'll be back in a little while. So the kid thinks, oh, well, you know, maybe I can dump it in the bathtub and then put the body in there, it'll be easier, you know, instead of crumpling them up in this canister or whatever. So he pours the thing in the bathtub and then dumps the body in there. Walks away and figures, hey, you know, when his teacher gets back, he'll be proud of me that I already got the body decomposed, you know. The guy comes back, and all of a sudden, he's like, what's that dripping? They look up at the ceiling, and there's some red liquid dripping through the ceiling. All of a sudden, boom, the whole ceiling caves in because the chemical that he dumped into the bathtub ate through the bathtub and into the floor. And, you know, so now they got this sloppy, bloody, disgusting mess all over the place. But, you know, it's supposed to make you laugh and think, oh, that's humor. It's disgusting, guys. There's body parts all over the place. You know. So there's another example of a show that's designed to degrade you, to demoralize you. Interestingly, I have a second cousin of mine that was actually one of the writers for that show, as it turns out. Interesting enough. But anyway, so that, you know, that was bad enough. That was gross. That was disgusting. I'm sure, you know, there were other shows like that that had gruesome, gross stuff. But now, guys, they're taking it to the next level with this series coming up. Always looking for ways to degrade you even more. Okay, they liked that. They didn't mind seeing decomposing bodies splattered all over the place, falling through the ceiling. Now let's see what else we can foist on them. Always, guys, always seeking to take you down even more. But check this out. A listener sent me this last night. If you take the name of the town that they chose for this, the setting of this storyline in this series. Santa Clarita. And you create an anachronism with it. You know, you scramble the letters around. Guess what, what you can spell. The name of the series, once again, is Santa Clarita Diet. You can rearrange the letters so that it spells Satanic Altar Diet. Isn't that interesting? You got to wonder, guys, of all the towns, cities across the country they could have chosen as the setting for this storyline, why did they choose Santa Clarita? Is it because, in fact, it can be scrambled to spell out Satanic Altar? Oh, I would guarantee you that that is the reason. So the real name of this show, given that acronym factor, is Satanic Altar Diet. And isn't that what Abramovic is all about? She eats the Satanic Altar Diet, doesn't she? Along with Podesta and the whole rest of the scumbags, and Mr. Colbert, too, as it turns out, who are tied in with this. Look how pervasive this is, guys. We see it in government, we see it in Hollywood. Just mentioned that high school, you know, might not involve human sacrifice and bloodletting, but hey, along the same lines, isn't it? You know, sexual assaults taking place by seniors against freshmen. Right under the noses of staff, and they did nothing about it. How much you want to bet? That's not an isolated case. Anyway, with that said, I must also point out that the mastermind behind this series is none other than Mr. Aaron Kaplan. I don't have to tell you what tribe he represents. No surprise there, guys, is it? No surprise. Anything and everything degrading, demoralizing, desensitizing, they're always, always behind it. Always. That's what they're all about. That's what they've always been about. They're doing to us now what they have done to so many societies around the globe for the past 3,500 plus freaking years. Right now, as we speak, they're doing it to us, guys. They're taking society down to the lowest common denominator, stripping people of their sense of morality, of decency, turning them into animals just like themselves, so that nothing will shock them. They'll shrug their shoulders. Whatever. No big deal. Why are you so upset about it? Who cares? That's the attitude today, isn't it? And that's how they can pawn off stuff like this as, quote, entertainment. the fact that people can be entertained by stuff like this, doesn't that scare the living crap out of you? Oh, are we ever in a lot of trouble? But anyway, enough of that. Let's get back to our notes there. Boston Strangler. Once again, guys, the Wicked Witch of the West, she had it right. Oh, what a wicked world! It really is. It really is. It almost makes you want to melt into a pile of wax, doesn't it, yourself? Ah, damn it. I had a friend just before the show text me, you know. Every once in a while, he'll do that. He's on his way to work, just disgusted with the whole mess. Here I go again, you know, slaving away, punching my little time clock, and have nothing to show for it. How many millions of people around the country, around the world, are in that same plight right now? Isn't it disgusting? And guess what? If they haven't gotten to you yet, stick around. They will. Oh, they will. Unless you're a part of their little elitist club, brushing shoulders with them and eating human flesh together at Abramovich Satanic Services. They're going to get to you eventually, too. They're going to take away your job and replace it with a robot or send it over to India, and you'll be making dirt wages, too, barely getting by. So disgusting, guys. And then they quote these statistics. Oh, no, unemployment is down. There's plenty of jobs. But, of course, they don't tell you that the jobs they're referring to are extremely substandard wage-paying jobs that don't have benefits, that don't hire you full-time, that don't pay a livable wage in the first place, even if you were working full-time. But they can get away with it because on paper, it looks good.
Yeah, we have all these jobs available now.
And even if you're only working 2.3 hours a week, you're working, right? So they can put you as part of that statistic now. You're not unemployed anymore.
You push a broom at McDonald's for 3.5 hours a week at 57.3 cents an hour. You're employed. All right. Woo. Yeah, the economy's booming.
I shudder to think where we're going to be, guys, in another 5 or 10 years. Like I said, I really, really wish I was born a generation or two earlier, where I could have lived my life in relative peace in a world with decent people, for the most part, anyway, that did give a frog's fat fanny about what was going on, that had scruples, that had decency, and where politicians were afraid of people, afraid of the population, and moved very cautiously with their shenanigans. No, not anymore. Not anymore. I wouldn't even mind half as much. Oh, I still would, but I mean, as far as my own self went personally, it wouldn't really matter to me that much on a personal level if I was, say, in my 70s or 80s, because I'd be checking out soon, you know. But I theoretically, I still got several decades left on this hellhole of a frickin' piece of crap. Anyway, back to our notes from yesterday. Boston Strangler. I left off talking about how what's his name? DeSalvo, you know, the one that they set up that made the obvious fake confession, was probably pressured into doing it, or MK-altered into doing it, whatever. A confession that should not have stood up to close scrutiny. In fact, you can bet your sweet fanny that Boston Police Department knew that this guy was not their man. This confession was just so full of holes. They accepted it because they were told to do so. They wanted to give the public the impression that, yep, yep, case is closed now. We saved the day. amongst other things, this series of murders served to, if they even happened, who knows, but they served to convince the public that, oh yeah, our leaders are our heroes. Might take them a while, but they finally caught this guy, so we can rest assured now. So it brought more trust, more artificial loyalties and patriotism, you know, blah, 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 blah. Distraction away from the burgeoning Vietnam War, right? Anyway, as I mentioned yesterday, DeSalvo had escaped from prison, but not so we could go out and commit more crimes. He just wanted to get attention to the fact that the conditions in the facility he was at were deplorable. While out, he didn't commit any murders because he had never committed any murders prior to that. He wasn't a murderer. Didn't even so much as rob anybody. Didn't do anything. He turned himself in shortly thereafter. And then we find, within a few years, he's dead. He was murdered. His killers or killer were never identified. No surprise there. Anyway, this man, again, was set up. There's no question about it. It was to their advantage. That he died in prison. They set him up that way. They had him killed, guys. They wanted him killed because apparently he was starting to open his mouth. Maybe he was fixing to do something to draw attention to himself in prison again. He had already done it before, right? They didn't want attention on this guy. Maybe he was fixing to tell, he was going to tell a story. Anyway, so, you know, I mean, he had his problems, no doubt. He was a pedophile, you know, back in the early 50s. He was arrested for, although he got off scot-free, didn't he? He walked. How did he do that? And then he did have, you know, kind of force himself on that woman there. Not kind of, he did. So he you know, he was a rapist. But, you know, was he MKUltra to do that? So that he would fit the bill for the Boston Strangler? I'd be willing to bet that that's exactly what happened. But notice, guys, he didn't kill the woman. He had no interest in killing her. He felt bad for her. He was apologizing. Obviously, this guy was severely messed with, wasn't it? Anyway, curiously, Kenneth Rowe, the witness in the Joan Graff murder, did not name DeSalvo as the man that he had communicated with just moments before Graff was murdered. The guy that he had seen, you know, looked entirely different, didn't match up with his description at all. Also, DeSalvo was not a smoker, and yet a brand of cigarettes, Salem, was found at the murder scene of Mary Sullivan and Sophie Clark. Two of the murder victims had Salem cigarette butts lying around. He did not smoke, Salem or otherwise. Another witness, just before Sophie Clark, just before she was murdered, met a man named Mr. Thompson, who was 5'9", with honey blonde hair. So that didn't match up with the salvo either. The physical sketch of the man apparently looked nothing at all like the salvo, not only a different color hair, but just, you know, his facial features altogether were nothing like his. So, guys, it's looking like, once again, they arrested a patsy, and they knew they were arresting a patsy. This information is readily available to the public. Do you think that law enforcement didn't know this stuff? Of course they did. They were either in on it, or they were simply told, back off.
National security.
And that was the end of that. Either way, we have another crime here that has gone unpunished, the real perpetrators, if they're even real, were murders. Who knows? I talked about the Manson killings, guys. Remember that? That is just unbelievably ridiculous. Those murders didn't even happen. They staged the whole freaking thing just for the psyops effect, you know. But nevertheless, whether this this spree of murders really happened or not, it doesn't matter. The real perpetrators walked, as we have seen so very many times before. Interestingly, the two women who had survived encounters immediately reacted to George Nasser, Albert's prison cellmate, the man who DeSalvo confided to and confessed to initially. At the time, Nasser had black hair, but both witnesses said that there were closer similarities between their attacker and Nasser physically than to DeSalvo. So was Nasser the killer? The whole trial that found DeSalvo, quote, guilty was, as you might guess, a complete charade, a complete sham. On January 10th, 1967, Albert DeSalvo was found guilty after 4 hours of deliberation and was sentenced to life in prison with no allowance for psychiatric help. Now, wasn't that interesting? Obviously, this guy needed psychiatric help, right? What the hell good is a prison system that doesn't offer any type of, reform? When you got someone like this, who's supposedly guilty of all these murders, guys, obviously there's some screws loose, right? He needs some mental help. They refused him mental help. And you know why? Because they know he was MK-altered and they didn't want that to surface. All right, guys, short break, right back.
Jewish professor Noel Ignatieff.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate, not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Hard-hitting talk radio.
So they tried DeSalvo, you know, amongst other things. They were trying to build this case against him. And so, you know, guilt by association, because they claimed he was connected with what was called the Green Man cases, where these two women were, they weren't even raped. I mean, they weren't penetrated. He performed conalinga, supposedly. But again, that has nothing to do with the Boston Strangler. But they were trying to create the illusion that because he was involved, even if he even was, but because he was involved in the Green Man case, therefore that makes him a murderer. See, he was involved in these other things, doing whatever they could to convince the jury. Guys, when have you ever seen a murder case like this decided in 4 hours of deliberation? I mean, this is unheard of. It's like they quickly wanted to just hurry up, get it over with, kind of like, you know, after 9/11, hurry up and clean up that debris, damn it! No investigation, no sectioning the area off and creating a grid and numbering each case as it's removed, cataloging it. No, photographing it. Nothing like that of the sort was done. Clean it up as quick as you can. The same thing here with this trial, guys. Just get a conviction, no matter what, at any cost. Hurry up. Before anybody decides to change their mind. He was never actually even particularly tried as the Boston Strangler. It was kind of understood that that's what the trial was about, but they never actually presented any evidence. They never were, there was nothing to nail him on regarding the Boston Strangler. They knew that there was tons of evidence that pointed in another direction about the cigarette butts, and, you know, on and on and on. Eyewitness accounts showing people there other than himself. He actually even later recanted his confession, by the way. Obvious, the confession that he gave was fake to begin with. And yet, he was given a life sentence, ultimately a death sentence, you know, since he was murdered. For what? In 2013, DNA evidence did link DeSalvo to the murder of 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, we're told. What's curious, though, is that this murder largely stands in contrast to the earlier murders that preceded it. Most specifically is the over-the-top staged setup, the Happy New Year's card, the physical biting of the body, and then leaving the sexual assault weapon at the crime scene. This was totally different from the other murders. So if, in fact, he was the murderer in that case, or in some way connected with it, was present, that doesn't connect him with the other murders, only this one. But this murder came later in the series, guys. Did they MK Ultra him as they had done with, you know, the Conalingus thing? Did they set him up to finally actually kill someone so they would have something on him? Who knows what the hell went on? Who knows if this DNA evidence was fake just to make it, you know, to make it look legitimate? Case closed. See, he was guilty, because there's so many other cases that have been popping up with government cover-up. You know what I'm saying? Awful funny how decades later in 2013, now they're claiming, oh, actually, we have DNA evidence to prove he's guilty. Really? Decades later? It was about this same time, guys, that they were claiming now, oh, new evidence shows that Eccles is innocent. New evidence shows, you know, stuff with the JonBenet case, on and on and on. Isn't it funny, all of a sudden, around that time, all this DNA evidence starts to surface regarding cases from decades earlier. Anyway, there's really only one conclusion to be drawn from this, since this particular crime scene was such an over-the-top setup. The DNA evidence is probably fraudulent, designed to silence the doubts that had arisen over the years, and doubts that were arising over other cases too. It's all damage control, guys. They realize, you know, people are starting to catch on and see there's a pattern here. This has been going on for a long time. One murder after another has been covered up when the evidence was so obvious Look at the Memphis 3 case right about this same time, a couple years earlier. But Memphis 3 case based on fraudulent DNA results, or maybe they aren't fraudulent, but the way they interpreted them was fraudulent. You know, they're acting like this new evidence showing there was someone else at the crime scene somehow exonerates the three that they had arrested and convicted with life and death sentences. No, that new DNA evidence doesn't show jack. All it shows is that, yeah, there was somebody else present. Probably that black guy that showed up in the restaurant, remember? Got blood all over the place, and it should have had the cops called on him immediately, but instead they let him sit in there for an hour in the ladies' room at that, not the men's room. Oh, the whole thing just reeks. In all of these cases, there wasn't a legitimate investigation. They were ignoring key pieces of evidence, paying attention to phony evidence, or hiring, friggin' psychics as a means of solving the case. It's just obvious BS, man. Letting the real perpetrators walk and setting up somebody innocent to take the fall. How many times we have seen this, folks? Again, it's disgusting, isn't it? Anyway, that concludes that discussion on the Boston Strangler. Let's look at something interesting now that was brought up, I think it was last week. Some of you may recall Vinny had called in. And, I was talking about the Challenger disaster. And he said, hey, have you looked into the idea that, you know, the passengers, or at least most of them on the Challenger, have been found to be alive? And no, I hadn't actually looked into that. But I got the link sent to me, and yeah, it's very interesting. So let's take a look at that. Oh, the things we've been lied to about. There's evidence that the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, ladies and gentlemen, of January 28, 1986, was not what it appeared to be. 6 out of the 7 alleged crew members apparently never died that day. This shouldn't surprise us, again, seeing how much government lies to us, how much NASA lies to us. But what would their agenda have been? Well, perhaps we'll never know exactly, but in any case, it's pretty clear that the official story behind this disaster was not what we were told. Don't forget, the whole reason I was talking about the Challenger disaster last week was in the context of the SDI thing. Now, SDI looks like it was a cover. It had nothing to do with containing the Soviets, blowing up their missiles before they ever reached us, before they even left Soviet territory. It was all about putting high-tech weapon systems in the air that would be used on us for mind control purposes and other things. So, you know, a lot of those secret shuttle missions pertain to that. They didn't want you to know about it because it was technology they were putting in space to be used on us. Anyway, so no surprise that we would see all kinds of shenanigans going on with the shuttle missions, right? Something was going on with the Challenger mission, guys. But anyway, before we get into that in any more detail, we have another caller here. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hey, Charlie. Don't want to interrupt your flow, but I just wanted to make a couple very brief comments about the Santa Clarita diet.
Yeah.
First of all, on Drew Barrymore, she's not only an actress in it, she's one of the executive producers.
Oh, okay, wow.
And executive producers, as opposed to producers who actually put the show together, executive producers help cut the checks to fund the enterprise.
There you go.
So her money is behind it. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that if you just search in various search engines, Santa Clarita diet, it's amazing how the internet is not just full of laudatory comments about this thing, such as Santa Clarita diet is surprisingly sweet, and Drew Barrymore poses with raw steak and still looks chic at the Santa Clarita diet premiere. But it's plain in your face that the internet is being scrubbed of negative comments, because I did a search, boycott Santa Clarita diet, or Santa Clarita diet disgusting or vile, and it took many, many pages before I got to any negative responses to this thing.
Wow.
So the whole internet is being rigged.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. They want to take us down to the lowest, as if we haven't been taken down low enough. No, it's never enough for them. Further and further down the rabbit hole we go. And like I said, it scares me to think of it, but I am willing to bet that this is going to be a popular show. Maybe not in reality, but they'll create the illusion that it is. And because of that, in time, people are going to start tuning in out of curiosity. And you watch, they'll get hooked.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, all of this begins using the tool of quote-unquote comedy and calling it a spoof or a satire or a dark comedy. That's how they introduce their most vile and wretched schemes.
Right. Yep. And this ranks right up the top, baby. This is, I couldn't believe it when I saw this. I'm like, no, tell me we're not that far gone. Oh, we are.
Right. This is really like a chapter from a dystopian novel. I couldn't believe it at first. But
yeah.
There evidently is no subterranean level to which these maggots will go. And, of course, we know who's behind it. Just look at the producers and such. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Charles.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Very important point. Wow. And again, guys, look how Bruce started out. We were talking about this yesterday, you know. They'll have you start out innocent and pure. You'll be a childhood actor. And later, they'll have you go off the deep end, and you wind up taking at least a good many of your following that has been fans of yours from when they were kids, right? They'll go right off the edge of the cliff with you because, after all, you're their hero, right? You're their fan, so you're going to follow right along. She started out, you know, doing flipping Disney films, right? Which, of course, upon close inspection, aren't very wholesome themselves a lot of times, are they? But nevertheless, you know, most people have that vision of Disney as being something innocent, and it's not, but, you know, nevertheless. Most Disney films, if you watch them without paying too much attention, seem innocent enough. And certainly that's the image that she had as a kid, right? Her and Jodie Foster, too, you know. Though Jodie hasn't quite gone up the deep end. Well, no, actually, look at... what the hell's that flipping show there with the Hannibal there? Hannibal... trying to think of the first one now that started that whole series. Oh, and they had part... 3, 4, 5, 8, 10, 15, whatever, a whole series that came out after that. But Hannibal the Cannibal, what the hell was the name of that? The original movie, now I can't think of it. But anyway, so yeah, she's not so wholesome either. Look at some of the garbage movies she's been in. See, this is how they work, guys. They start out innocent, you know, childhood actors. Everybody enjoyed, so innocent and pure. And now, look at this. Anyway, but like I said, you watch, guys, this show, I'm telling you, just like Breaking Bad became real popular. Oh, they got all their creative writers out for this one, I can bet. And they're going to make it so that you're on the edge of your seat. You just got to see that next episode. What's going to happen now? And even though you might be sickened at the whole theme of it, you know, the Hannibal thing, you know, the storyline is going to hook a lot of people, and they're going to want to keep tuning in. What happens next? And yet all the while, whether they realize it or not, they're becoming desensitized. And something that is vulgar, filthy, disgusting, despicable is going to become something, well, not such a big deal after all. In fact, it's kind of funny. Wow. They've got us pushed to the edge of the cliff, and now they're poising to, you know, push us right off the edge. Anyway, back to our challenger discussion here. We're going to go through the list of crew members here and see that, yes, all but one of them have been found to still be alive, guys. Ellison S. Onizuka is said to be survived conveniently by an identical twin brother, Claude. Isn't that interesting? We've seen this before, haven't we, guys? Oh, I think some of the alleged victims of the Sandy Hook shooting. Nod, nod, wink, wink. Several of the victims there supposedly had twins. And so, you know, the illusion is created that, oh, this isn't really the person that we said died. No, it's their twin brother or twin sister. Yeah. How many twins were there in that case? Well, we've got two sets of twins that were on the Challenger, we're told. Or, I mean, two people who were part of, you know, an identical twin pair. Isn't that just a little too coincidental, guys? Here's one, this first one here, Ellison Onizuka. Yes, he's dead. This guy who looks exactly like him is actually his twin brother. Not him. This guy's name is Claude, so of course it's not the same guy. Yeah, right. I looked at another website. This guy had dug into it pretty deep, and he saw no birth record for a Claude Onizuka. Several of these people aren't even mentioned in the Social Security's death index either. Even if they are, they can just fake that. But no, they're not even there, just like a lot of the 9/11 victims, guys. Remember that? A lot of the planes weren't listed as being out of commission until years later after 9/11. That's pretty bizarre, isn't it? Anyway, let's go on to the next crew member, Ronald E. McNair. Also survived by,
coincidentally,
an alleged identical twin brother, Carl McNeil. Oh, my God. Come on, guys. Come on. Are you freaking kidding? Jesus. I'll send the check out right away. Just make sure you mail me that bridge as soon as you can. Look at this. Two of the crew members just happen to have twin brothers that are still alive. Yeah, I'm buying that one. Pilot Mike J. Smith didn't even bother changing his name. There's a Professor Michael J. Smith, same middle initial, at the University of Wisconsin, who looks exactly like the Michael J. Smith of Challenger fame. You're going to tell me that it's a different person? Both are Michael J. Smiths. Both of them look exactly alike. Predictably, both of these Michael J. Smiths were born in 1945, guys.
But no, they're two different people.
Look exactly alike, have exactly the same names, born the same year, but no, they're two different people. Sharon Krista McAuliffe, school teacher that was aboard that shuttle, or so we're told, was known in her astronaut days by her middle name, Krista. But today, she uses her first name, Sharon, and is a Syracuse law professor. Sharon McAuliffe looks exactly like her. But now she uses her first name, so people won't make the connection. Oh, wow, she looks like that. What was that name? Krista. Yeah, Krista McAuliffe. But obviously it's not her, because this one's name is Sharon. Her real name was Sharon. Judith A. Resnick hasn't bothered changing her name either. She's now a law professor at Yale. Notice, two of these people are now law professors. By the way, digital voice analysis reveals a perfect match for both pre and post. Challenger disaster voices for her. So it's not just, you know, facial similarities. The voice matches up perfectly. Francis R. or Dick, he's known as Dick. Francis R. Scobie is now known as Dick Scobie, and is the CEO of a Chicago-based company called Cows in Trees Limited. Again, looks exactly the same. And Scobie, of course, is not a very common name now, is it? Gregory Jarvis is the only crew member on the Challenger mission that hasn't turned up still living. Was he wanted out of the way for some reason? Was he expendable? Was he the only one of the seven listed Challenger crew members who was really on that spacecraft and did die? And the others are just unknown? Who knows, guys? Who knows? For all we know, there was nobody on that shuttle. But why would they do this? That's the question. Well, we know that there was all kinds of shenanigans going on at the time, right? With, SDI and so forth. But why specifically would they blow the shuttle up? What would they get out of that? Well, let's take a look. Actually, before we even do that, let's look at some other strange facts surrounding this Challenger disaster. No surprise, guys. At the time of the Challenger launch, live cameras had captured McAuliffe's parents on film the whole time. And after the shuttle exploded, they showed no look of horror on their faces whatsoever. Nor are they talking to or embracing one another. In fact, several minutes after the explosion, when it was more than obvious that the situation was definitely hopeless, both mother and father can actually be seen smiling. Isn't it obvious they were in on the gag and knew their daughter had not just died in front of their eyes? You have to draw that conclusion if you watch the video and see them smiling, guys. There's no flippant way you could possibly be smiling as you're witnessing your daughter's body being blown to smithereens in the skies above. No. You're not going to be smiling. And you're not going to be indifferent so as to not be looking at your spouse and embracing your spouse and not have shocked looks on your face and be crying for that matter. No. That's very telling right there. But why? Again, we come back to the question. What would the motive have been? Well, it's a very good motive. All you got to do with any of these things is look at what was going on at that time. What was happening? What could have served as a reason to stage something like this? Why would they want to have self-sabotaged the shuttle mission? Because that's what happened, right? There were no shuttle missions for at least, two, 3 more years after that. And once the shuttle missions did get going again, there were some major changes that took place, and those changes, or one of them anyway, definitely clues us in as to why they would want to stage this. Reagan, as it turns out, was the one who implemented the program of, putting teachers on shuttle missions on a regular basis. Apparently this was his idea, initiated it. Apparently the powers that be didn't want that, but he had popularized it before they could put a stop to it. So, they let it go forward, or at least seemingly go forward, but then they sabotaged it, guys. Doesn't this sound familiar? This is what happened with Lee Harvey, right? They sent him over to Russia, supposedly defecting. He was trained in our most advanced radar systems. The next thing you know, he comes back, and bingo! Suddenly now the Russians are able to track the U-2 spy plane, whereas prior to that time, they couldn't even come close. Their radar didn't have that kind of range, right? Now they're able to track this thing way, way high up and shoot it down. Right after Oswald comes back from his so-called defection thing, at which time he's allowed right back into the country, no questions asked. He wasn't raked over the coals. No. It's obvious what went on there. They sabotaged the U-2 plane deliberately so that the peace talks wouldn't go through and, you know, Kennedy wouldn't be able to bring an end to the Cold War. Want that to happen. That's their bread and butter, right? The same thing here, guys. They didn't want this Reagan-instituted teacher-in-space program. The policy was they were going to be doing this on a regular basis. They were going to be teachers on pretty much every mission after that. Oh, no, they didn't want that because they wanted to engage in secret activities in space. They wanted nobody to know about, right? They sabotaged it because that brought an end to the program. All right, guys, I'll break right back.
Circus Maximus provides an in-depth analysis of geopolitics, historical events, social engineering, and the kosher Nostrad who are attempting to bring about a global, technocratic feudal system. Nick Spiro brings forth his passion and years of research, unveiling the esoteric agendas of the deep state, black operations, NGOs, think tanks, secret societies, ancient bloodlines, and controlled opposition movements behind the Jewish veil. Tune in live every Friday night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Renegade Broadcasting.
Hey guys, welcome back. Interestingly enough, guess what the name of the director was for the program of putting teachers into space? Perry Rosenblatt. Maybe he's the guy that came up with the idea of sabotaging the mission, creating the illusion that all of the astronauts were blown to bits. Here's another interesting factoid to consider. After the Challenger wreckage was examined, you can call it that.
Investigation.
The pieces were buried and sealed in abandoned Minuteman missile silos at Cape Canaveral, where they remain to this day. Isn't that interesting? Why do you suppose that they would do that? They don't ever want anyone examining them. That's why. Just like, guys, the frickin', remember the TWA Flight 800 fiasco back in 1996 there that was shot down?
Oh, excuse me, it blew up.
Shut it down, guys. Over 600 people up and down the East Coast around Long Island said that they saw a missile being fired from sea level, meeting up with the plane, and then the plane blew up. But they covered that all up, didn't they? Oh, yes, yes. There was one guy who cut out a piece of a back of one of the seats in the plane that had some residue on it, and he sent it to this reporter that he knew was looking into it. He said, have this tested at an independent lab, and you will see that this material, this residue, is in fact cordite. It's an explosive, He says there was a hole blown into the side of the fuselage from outside, not from in. The explosion originated from outside. It was a missile. A hole created by a missile penetrating the plane. And it dispersed this explosive residue. Well, she never was able to take that to a lab to have it tested because the FBI showed up at her door shortly after the mail got delivered to her. And the agent demanded she hand over the evidence, and if she didn't, she tried to play dumb. What evidence? What are you talking about? What package? Ma'am, we know you just had it delivered to you. Don't play dumb with if you do not hand it over, you're going to be prosecuted for tampering with a federal investigation. Can you imagine? And, of course, he confiscated it, and that was the end of that. But how do you like that, guys? How do you like that? 6 out of the 7 crew members of the Challenger disaster never died. They're still alive. All right, that's the end of that discussion. There's something different, not a completely different tag. It's still dealing with a murder cover-up, but of a completely different nature here. This is something that I had read about years ago, read a book on it, and kind of forgot it, filed it in the back of my mind somewhere. It was interesting. I thought, the evidence was pretty convincing, but I just kind of moved on to other things, and I recently returned to that subject because I came across an article a few weeks back, and immediately it reminded me of the book I had read years ago. So I dug the book out, and I started comparing it with this article, and then I branched off from there and did some more digging, and sure enough, I realized, wow, there really is a lot more to this than I thought. It deals with, and of course, I talked about this subject before, but not from this angle. The Lincoln assassination. Now, many of you will recall a series I did a while back on Lincoln showing that he not only had very deep and far-reaching tribal connections, but apparently he was a tribe member himself. Well, of course, when you consider that all of our president's guys have been interrelated with British royalty, which itself is interrelated with the tribe, with the Merovingian bloodline. So in that sense, yeah, he was a tribe member. But no, he was far more so a tribe member than just having, some of their blood in his veins. Apparently, he was through and through, as I pointed out when I did that show. And that it looks like we have an example with his assassination of them killing their own, which is not unusual. They've done it before many times. He was serving them very well. The problem is, there were two different factions, the North and the South, right? Both being run by the tribe. The South hated them. They wanted slavery to continue. The North loved them, and, it was to their advantage financially to get rid of slavery. And so they made a concession, basically. The North said, all right, we'll let you guys take them out. Even though he served us quite well. We're pretty much done with him anyway. We got what we wanted out of him. Even though he is one of our own, we'll make a hero out of him later, right? So he'll still go down in the record books as a great man. You know, it's just one of those concessions that they've had to make. Just like through the centuries, the royal and the priestly bloodline have fought against each other at one minute, the next minute kissing each other's hind parts back and forth, because the third faction came along now, the secret societies and their banking enterprise. Now it became advantageous for them to work together because they have a common foe that poses a threat to both of their power, right? So, you know, you had killings going on behind the scenes, you know, popes were getting killed and kings were getting killed, and they turned around and retaliated by wiping out a good deal of the Templars, but then they came back later and created things like the Reformation and the Renaissance, and ultimately they won, right? They took down the royalty and the church, stripped both of their power. A lot of people see that as a good thing, but no, not really. Because ultimately, look where it wound us up. Are we any better off for it? The church has lost a significant amount of power, as has the royal families, but has that made a difference? No. It's still the tribe running the show, just a different faction. Anyway, so that's what was going on with the Lincoln assassination, guys. Lincoln was not a good boy. That's not why they killed him. He just betrayed one of the factions of the tribe, so he had to go. And I pointed out how, I did a show on his assassination and showed all the problems with that. It's just an impossible scenario. It couldn't ever have played out the way we were told if we had a legitimately running system, a Secret Service detail that, you know, wasn't doing its job. They were partying across the street in a bar. I mean, it's just, you know, there was no protection there. They left him wide open because he was set up, right? On the one hand, you could argue, well, who cares? He was a traitorous scumbag. And he was. Mr. Trashed the Constitution by getting rid of habeas corpus. He was a tyrannical monstrosity from hell. Praised as an American hero. Oh, knock it off. He was no such thing. But nevertheless, looking at his murder is very interesting because it's multifaceted. There was a lot of stuff going on there. One of the things going on, guys, was, believe it or not, papal involvement in Lincoln's assassination. Oh, yeah. Oh, we can see the third faction involved, but by this time, they were already working together, weren't they? Even though the third faction had already stripped the royal and priestly bloodlines of much of their power, the royal and priestly bloodlines also realized that if they were going to be able to maintain any of their existence in any form, they had to cooperate now with this much more powerful third faction, right? So that's what was going on. The royal and priestly bloodlines by this point, and it's been that case ever since, been that way ever since, have been cooperating with the secret societies and their banking enterprises, and have all mutually benefited thereby. It's been the secret societies leading the pack. The royal and priestly bloodlines have been there to ride on their coattails and benefit financially and to some degree politically or in other ways of power and influence as well. Under their auspice, but nevertheless, they're still allowed to share a piece of the pie, only in so much as they cooperate with secret societies and their banking system. So that's what went on here with Lincoln. You see Freemasons working behind the scenes, orchestrating this. You see the elite pig scum over in, Charleston, which was the headquarters of B'nai B'rith, as well as Scottish Rite Freemasonry Southern Jurisdiction, right? That's where Albert Pike hung out. You see all that going on, but there was also a collaboration going on. You know, there was some British royalty that had an axe to grind in this. They were playing a role. So you see the royal bloodline, but you also see the priestly bloodline. Roman Catholic Church, ladies and gentlemen, played a role in the assassination of Lincoln. It did. So let's take a look at this now. The evidence is pretty jaw-dropping once you look at it. Again, though Lincoln was a traitorous, at least you pick himself, he was clearly betrayed and murdered by his own fellow tribesmen. But his murder didn't just involve a behind-the-scenes contention between the tribe in the North and the tribe members in the South. It also involved a contention between royal and priestly bloodline Jews. Lincoln, like all other U.S. presidents, represented and indeed was genetically tied in with the royal bloodline, which was, as it almost always has been, in opposition with the priestly bloodline, represented by the hierarchy of the Vatican. Anyway, there were some royal factions that wanted him out of the picture too, but generally speaking, he did represent, you know, the royal bloodline, political power, which was seen as a threat to the secular power. At this time, the secret societies did not have complete control yet. They had reduced the power of the royal and police priestly bloodlines, but they didn't have complete control. So there were some collaborations going on back and forth where, you know, the priestly bloodline would collaborate with the third faction against the kingly bloodline and vice versa, the kingly against the priestly. In this particular example, it was the priestly bloodline collaborating with the third faction against the royal bloodline. Because this guy, or at least what he represented, you know, the U.S., religious liberty, was a big problem for the Catholic Church. We're going to look at some amazing quotes from the then reigning Pope, Pius IX, later on in these notes, that show that he absolutely detested the United States and its principles of freedom. Understand, that's something that the third faction came up with, guys, not because they give a frog's fat fanny about human liberty, no. But to them, it was their way of waging war against the Catholic Church. They didn't care if you had freedom. In fact, in reality, did we ever really have freedom in this country? No, only the illusion thereof. Oh, for some time, you know, a majority of Americans did enjoy some freedom in that way. Yeah, freedom of speech, you know, freedom of religion, blah, 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 blah. But only for window dressing purposes, really. Just to reduce the power of the priestly line. But now, having done that, and now infiltrating it with their third faction leaders, you know, Masons saturating the Vatican leadership now, now they don't care if the Vatican rises to prominence again, because they have complete control over it. They don't have to worry about it being a threat to their monopoly, you see. But back in the 1860s, they didn't have that complete control yet. But what they did is they conspired with the Pope. They realized, hey, he can be of great assistance to us. They didn't have complete control, but they allowed them to work together with them because they had a mutual interest to be served thereby. Like I said, guys, I'm getting ahead of myself, but the Vatican, especially under Pius IX, had a rabid hatred. By this point, it was almost 100 years now into this new government that was based on freedom of religion, where the Catholic Church could not impose its will on the populace of this country because there was separation of church and state. They hated that. So now the third faction comes along and says, oh, you don't like that? Okay. You want to get rid of this guy? You want revenge? You know, against this nation, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Fine, we want him out of the way, too. So we'll work with you. We'll help you take him down. Pope Pius IX had the taste of Lincoln's blood on his lips, guys, as we'll see from his own pen, some of the stuff he said. Not only hated Lincoln, he just hated this country, period, because of its freedom of religion. That was what gave the Catholic Church its power for so very many centuries on end. Trampling people's right to decide for themselves what they're going to believe, if they're going to believe, who they're going to believe in. They lost that. with, you know, in other ways they had already lost that, but not to the degree they did when the United States Constitution came along. That was the end of it. Anyway, hard drive is turning wildly right now. I have no idea why. Hope I'm even coming in. All right, there it goes. Boys of Tel Aviv again playing their games, I guess. So yeah, let's see how much time. Yeah, we only got about 10 minutes left, but I hate when this happens. You know, a cliffhanger over the long weekend. I really hate to break this up because it just flows so smoothly, and I hate to interrupt the flow of thought. Maybe I'll recap what I cover right now on Monday. I don't know, but the evidence, guys, it's very damning. But this shouldn't surprise us, because if you look at the history of this abominable cult called the Catholic Church, all through the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, this is all they did. In fact, I don't even mention that in these notes. I really need to mention that now. That might take us to the end of the show. Because that's really the context for understanding this, the whole Lincoln thing. If you don't understand that they have a long history of doing stuff like this, then the Lincoln thing seems like, you know, you don't really have, you know, a case to make a claim like this, in spite of all the evidence there too. But once you understand the context of it, it's like 9/11. When you talk with someone about 9/11, you need to explain to them the long history the U.S. has had of false flag operations, like the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, Operation Northwoods, you know, on and on and on. Once people see all of that, they're prepped for understanding 9/11 as an inside job, because, yeah, oh, they've been doing this for decades. Wow, you know, to use as a pretext to launch phony wars, amongst other things. The same here with the Vatican guys. Once you understand that they had been involved for a very long time in infiltrating nations, taking kings down that weren't cooperating with them, you know, they had run into a lot of problems over the century, where this, that, or the other king was resisting their authority. Don't forget, historically, the priestly bloodline was always believed to have authority over the kingly. But the kingly, you know, just like the messianic movement of the first century, right? They were looking for two different messiahs, a kingly and a priestly messiah. But the priestly was to have dominance over the kingly. I talked about this when we discussed John the Baptist, if you may recall, and how Jesus was in contention with John, vying for control. He didn't want to give up any of his power as a member of the royal bloodline of David, right? He didn't want this priestly messiah circumventing his authority. Ultimately, guys, I'm convinced he had John the Baptist murdered. He was behind the whole damn thing. That's why he didn't say a word or do a thing to get him set free out of prison. He could have set off a revolt, an uprising, and had John freed from you know, from the cell. No, he didn't do anything. He wanted him dead. As soon as John was dead, that's when he starts boldly proclaiming, I am the one. There's no way to the Father but by me. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Blah, blah, blah. He never talked that way while John was still alive. Isn't that interesting? There you have an example, once again, of the priestly and the royal bloodline contending for power. Jesus, after that, emerged as the kingly and the priestly Messiah rolled into one. Talk of that didn't exist prior to that time. He could only become so bold because John was now out of the way, right? Anyway, all during the Dark Ages, the same thing, guys, the same battle. The priestly and the bloodly, yeah, the priestly and the kingly bloodline vying for power back and forth at each other's throats. The Vatican with its spy network infiltrating, you know, different royal families that were not cooperating, or, you know, this, that, or the other king infiltrating his court, having him assassinated, whatever. There were times, guys, where popes, once a king realized, oh, I'm not going to get anywhere standing up to the priestly bloodline. This guy has too much power. where his own countrymen rose up against him for defying an order of the Pope. The Pope would order such a king. There was one that was ordered to come to Rome and lie naked on a cold marble floor all night, begging and pleading with the Pope before finally the next day he agreed. Okay, I'll forgive you. But, and then he made him change a bunch of laws and, you know, ensure that Peter's pence was going to be sent down regularly every month from that point on. There was another king who was made to sit outside his royal arse's court for a whole night in the freezing cold during a blizzard on his horse. And finally, when he was near the point of death, almost freezing to death from hypothermia, finally, his not-so-holiness allowed him to come into the warm castle now and heard his confession. But once again, he humiliated him, degraded him, stripped him of much of his power, let him go back as king, but only as his minion now, and changing a bunch of laws, you know, blah, 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 blah. You see what was going on here, guys? This went on for centuries on end. And usually it was the Vatican that won. There were some instances where kings rose up successfully. They had their countrymen behind them, and the Vatican was powerless to stop them, at least for a time, anyway. But most of the time, guys, the kings caved in. The royal bloodline caved into the priestly bloodline. The Pope won out, who had many, many tricks up his sleeve to turn a troublemaking royal figure into a compliant butt-kisser. Sometimes, especially later on, you know, with the Jesuits, he would send the Jesuits out into the king's court without it being known that they were Jesuits, you know. They would infiltrate the thing and either sway the king or have him killed. So now when we come to Abraham Lincoln, guys, this is, you know, to see Vatican involvement in his assassination, this is just a long train of events, just another link in a long chain like this. This is just them carrying out their modus operandi that they had been engaged in for centuries, you know, prior to that time. I really should have mentioned that in these notes because that's so important to get that historical context. So with that said, now, you know, we're more prepped to discuss Vatican involvement in Lincoln's assassination. Motive number one. Lincoln represented a challenge to Rome's power, as I said. Rome, the priestly bloodline, had long been opposed to and had fought against any secular rule or secular ruler, royal bloodline member, that didn't accept the alleged primacy of the Pope's authority. You know how many times the Vatican has made statements? They're still there today, guys, in you know, the Catholic Encyclopedia, in the canon law book, on and on and on. Many Catholic prominent theologians that are held in such high esteem today from past centuries have written volumes on, you know, Francis de Liguori, for example, or Lucius Ferraris from the 18th century, said that the Pope has authority over kings. He may appoint or depose them at will. Do you know how many times statements like this have been made? Constantly asserting and reasserting the priestly bloodline authority over the kingly bloodline. Kingly bloodline never liked that. But the Pope, having so many dupes, having so many subjects of these various kings that may not have liked the Pope having that power, but, you know, felt powerless to stop him and override him because their own subjects had more loyalty to the Pope than to themselves. You see my point. Most kings were afraid to stand up to the Pope's authority because he knew that such a king knew that his own subjects would overthrow him, right? All the Pope would have to say is, okay, I'm excommunicating your entire nation because you're not cooperating with me, king, whatever, whatever, you know. That, folks, to the gullible masses at the time, meant exclusion from heaven. You're automatically going to hell because the Pope has excommunicated your entire country. So now the king became an enemy of the people, you see. Look at the power they had. So for Lincoln to come along, who represented a nation that stood against Rome's authority, they hated this country. They hated the Constitution, albeit as rigged as it was. And they hated Lincoln because he represented that nation. The Vatican always has and still does, guys. Oh, I've got reams of quotes. Technically, I should include those in these notes too, but, you know, this thing would wind up being a book by the time I was done if I included everything I wanted to. But I got mounds of quotes where the Vatican, even up into modern times, has denounced the U.S. And in fact, I do have a few of those quotes in here. We'll look at those on Monday. Some of them. Where the Vatican has denounced the U.S. Constitution of freedom, of liberty, of conscience. In fact, I am himself, the reigning pope of the time of Lincoln. We'll look at some of that on Monday. All right, guys, have a great weekend. We'll get into the real heart of this then. Thanks for joining.
Gives us one side of World War II. They don't want us to know the real history of what happened over 70 years ago, seeing through the eyes of the German victims. The horror of the terror bombing, the mass rape of millions of women and children, the torture and murder of civilians, the death camps for surrendered soldiers, the ethnic cleansing of whole countries, and the planned extermination of the entirety of the German people. After watching Hellstorm, you'll never see the good war and the good guys in the same light ever again. Watch for free and get DVDs at hellstormdocumentary.com.